Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. As Tuesday's election looms, we will begin with an overview of voting in America with a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation. Richard Hassan, the author of The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown, joins us to discuss fraudulent charges of voter fraud on the right and voting machine conspiracy theories on the left that together have diminished confidence Americans have in the integrity of voting. Then we will speak with one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to everyday life. Joining us is Toby Miller, a professor at the City University of London, where he has an article at their website, The Race for the White House 2012, The New American Dream. We will discuss the irony that wealth-producing and knowledge-generating centers in the blue states of the country, like New York and California, that vote Democrat, subsidize Republican right-wing welfare in socialist red states who vote Republican. Then finally, we'll examine how much Mitt Romney has got away with in the election due to our pathetic press and the feckless Democrats who have not forced him to reveal his taxes and list of bundlers. We'll discuss another aspect of Mitt Romney that has also been off limits, his role as a member of Mormon royalty and his connection to the vast finances generated by tithing that the secretive hierarchy of the Mormon prophet and his disciples have at their disposal. Kay Birmingham, the author of An American Fraud, One Lawyer's Case Against Mormonism, joins us. And joining us now is Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert on election law and campaign finance regulation and is co-author of a leading casebook on election law. He served as founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal, and he is the author of more than 80 articles on election law issues published in numerous journals, including the Harvard Law Review, Stanford Law Review, and Supreme Court Review. His latest book just out is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Hassan.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And just today, on Sunday, in Florida, there's a last-minute lawsuit from the Florida Democrats trying to extend early voting because of long lines. Of course, the governor has no sympathy for that. He'd already been sued because he tried to stop the whole process of early voting, at least in terms of the time. And now we also learn on Friday that this Ohio Secretary of State, John Husted, a Republican, has in a last-minute 11th-hour legal move, which many people think could swing the entire election, he issued a directive that lays out requirements for submitting provisional ballots, and the directive includes a form which puts the burden on the voter to correctly record the form of ID provided to election officials. This, of course, is all part of the myriad of tricks in this torturous voting wars that we have in this country. But in those cases, in both these key states, Florida and Ohio, are these latest examples likely to be as effective as some people are reporting?
Well, I've been saying all along that the extent to which these rule changes make a difference has been exaggerated by the left, and that the amount of votes that are at stake with these kinds of changes is very small. However, especially in Florida right now, the polling looks extremely close. We saw very contradictory polls yesterday. It's not clear who's going to win. And if we're talking about, again, a Florida 2000 type margin, which was maybe 1,000 votes, 500 votes, 2,000 votes, you know, depending on what time period we looked at, then these small changes like cutbacks in early voting could, in fact, make a difference. It's the same thing with the situation in the state of Ohio right now, although the polling is not quite as close. At least most of the polling shows President Obama with a small but persistent lead. But if it does come down to the provisional ballots, the fight here now is over counting provisional ballots that have mistakes on them. And the courts have already ruled, contrary to what the Ohio officials wanted, that if there's a mistake in the casting of a provisional ballot caused by a poll worker, the ballot has to be counted. And so what it looks like Husted is doing here is trying to put the onus on the voter. And so if the voter makes the mistake, those ballots won't be counted and there won't be any recourse in the federal courts for that.
Well, he has. The Secretary of State of Ohio has instructed the election officials that if the form is not filled out correctly by the voter, the ballot should not be counted. But you're saying that that would eventually be tested with a lawsuit.
Well, it's already being tested in a lawsuit. So this was challenged, and there was an emergency motion filed over the weekend. And the same judge who ruled earlier that those provisional ballots that were caused by poll worker error, that those have to be counted, is before the same judge, and the judge has asked Husted to respond by Monday as to how these ballots are going to be handled. I should point out that under the rules that Ohio has put out, these provisional ballots will not even start to be counted until November 17th. So if we as a country are unlucky enough to have the election come down to Ohio, and it's a very close margin in Ohio, it's going to be weeks before we find out who's won that election.
Well, we know, I think, Richard Hassan, that the storm, for example, in New Jersey and New York is going to depress the popular vote. And there's a sense that perhaps Obama will win the Electoral College and perhaps Romney will win the popular vote. And with a million votes now not coming from these blue states, New York and New Jersey, that will depress the popular vote for Obama. And, of course, people who vote for the Green candidates and others, even though some, I did a interview the other day with a very soporific, a so-called progressive, who were just mad at Obama, like most of the progressives, the people who call themselves progressives apparently are, saying that, well, you can vote your conscience in other states like California, but not in the swing states. You have to vote against Romney. And I pointed out, well, that's going to depress the popular vote, which is important. How important do you think the popular vote would be? My sense is the Tea Party people already think this president is illegitimate and a Muslim from Kenya. So if we end up with that scenario with Obama winning the presidency but losing the popular vote, won't the Tea Party people be riled up?
Well, I think that if there's an Obama victory, the Tea Party people will be riled up either way. I was actually heartened a little bit to see that someone like Dick Morris and also Karl Rove were making noises that if Obama wins, it's going to be because of the luck of Hurricane Sandy hitting when it did. That's better than the alternative of saying that there's been voter fraud, which has marred the outcome of the election. In my book, The Voting Wars, I talk about how on the Republican side, there's been a great hue and cry about an epidemic of voter fraud, but most of this is manufactured, and the kind of fraud that happens is not the kind of fraud that the Republicans are addressing in this new wave of laws that they've been passing.
So again, I'm speaking with Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert on election law and campaign finance regulation. And his latest book just out is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. And it's pretty hard to believe that after the shame of Florida in 2000, when a lot of Americans suddenly felt that their electoral system was like that of a banana republic, and there was a flurry of legislative attempts and a lot of money was spent, and of course nothing improved, and the FCC is essentially a broken government watchdog. And as you've just mentioned, Richard Hassan, you've got on the right side of the political spectrum, you've got these fraudulent fraud squads and this whole idea of voter fraud, which is largely a myth, being propagated. And on the left, you've got these conspiracy theories about rigged voting machines, and people have been crying wolf forever about Diebold and other things. So the overall picture is pretty murky. Can you clarify it a little bit?
Well, I do think that we as a country learned the wrong lessons since 2000. One of the things I show is that the amount of election litigation has more than doubled. People's confidence in the fairness of the election process has gone down. And it turns out that when you're on the losing side of an election, you're more likely to believe that the way the system was run was somehow rigged or unfair than if you're on the winning side of the election. It's part of, a consequence of the hyper-polarized society we live in right now. And I do think that that spawns conspiracy theories on the left and the right, and it leaves room for provocateurs and political entrepreneurs to further fan the flames and undermine the legitimacy of our whole process. And what we need to do, and I argue at the end of my book, is move to the kind of system they have in most mature democracies, which is nationalized, nonpartisan election administration run by professionals who are adequately staffed and independently insulated from political pressures. we are just so far from that. Since 2000, we haven't moved in that direction. If anything, we've moved in the opposite direction. Things have become much more politicized than they were before.
Well, the impression I get, Richard Hassan, is that neither party really wants to fix this broken system. First of all, the states administer it, and that goes back to the founding fathers. The first demand of the 13 colonies was that they had to conduct independent elections. And that I recall that after 9/11, in the Patriot Act, there was a provision for a national ID card because there was a sense that because these hijackers were apparently running around the U.S. with all kinds of IDs that are readily available. The notion was that in order to have homeland security, you have to know who's in this country to begin with, have to do a kind of inventory. So I'm always wondered why, you know, we can't make a deal with the devil here. For progressives who are concerned, you know, they don't want to have the Gestapo saying, show me your papers on the one hand. But on the other hand, if you have a national ID card and it's used for elections, the same government that gives you an ID card can't say that you're voting fraudulently. I mean, that's how the rest of the world operates. Do you think it'll ever happen? I mean, or a better question might be, why doesn't it happen?
Yeah, well, I think, I've proposed for years that we move to a system of universal voter registration conducted by the government, the federal government. And as part of that deal, you move to a national ID card, and you include with it, if a voter wants, a thumbprint. This would be at the voter's option, and the voter could use the thumbprint in lieu of the card because you're not going to lose your thumb. I like to say this is a proposal that has united Democrats and Republicans because it's united them against the idea. Republicans don't want to expand the electorate. They don't want to have universal registration, and Democrats don't want the ID card. I think it gets caught up in issues related to immigration. It gets caught up with libertarians and privacy advocates, gets caught up on that side. And the broader point is that there doesn't seem to be common space for electoral reforms right now. If you look at the wave of voter ID laws, with the exception of Rhode Island, they've all been passed by Republican legislators and opposed by Democratic legislators. Out here in California, if you look at Election Day registration, it's supported only by Democrats and opposed by Republicans. And so it's very hard in the midst of this strong period of party polarization to find this kind of common ground. And I would have liked to think that Florida 2000 would have been the wake-up call, but it didn't work out that way. And I don't know if it's going to take another election meltdown before the country is willing to wake up and take some steps to have a mature system for running the elections.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation, and his latest book just out is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. So you would think, though, the only way I think to fix this would be for the American people to be sufficiently ashamed of this embarrassingly broken system that's so easily gamed and has been gamed since the beginning of the Republic, routinely. And both parties, for various reasons, have deadlocked any efforts to reform it. So perhaps if people were sufficiently outraged and just wanted this nonsense to stop, they may be able to weigh in, because I don't personally understand the motivations for the kind of mendacity and malice that the governor of Florida and the secretary of state of Ohio are exhibiting now. I mean, the idea that in a democracy you don't want people to vote should be considered an absolute disgrace.
Well, I have a piece today in the Sacramento Bee where I argue that at bottom this is not just, although it is somewhat about partisan gain, it's also a difference of philosophies about the nature of voting. I think Republicans are much more likely to view voting as about choosing the best candidate. And if that's what it's about, then you can imagine excluding voters who you think are not intelligent enough or literate enough or who have not shown sufficient ties to the community. So you could have property tests and all of these things. And so cutbacks in early voting and making it harder for people to vote is supposed to wean out those who shouldn't be voting in the first place. And if you take that philosophy, I think you can understand some of the approaches that are coming from the right. On the left, I think elections are viewed more as allocation of power among political equals. And if you take that view, then you want to be as inclusive as possible. For the Democrats to claim inclusion, you have to realize there's some self-interest there, too. The broader the electorate, the more likely it is there are going to be these casual voters who sometimes vote and sometimes don't, who are going to favor the Democratic Party. It's not a coincidence that Democrats don't want to take steps to remove ineligible voters from the voting rolls, like non-citizens, which we know is a real but small problem, because they'd rather err on the side of inclusion, while Republicans would rather err on the side of exclusion. And what we really need is somebody whose allegiance is to the integrity of the electoral process, who says that the goal is to make sure that all eligible voters, but only eligible voters, can cast a vote which will be fairly and accurately counted. It's very simple to state, but it's hard to find a mechanism to get that into place.
So just in closing then, Richard Hassan, in this election, which is coming up in the next couple of days, and there's last-minute campaigning in the swing states, I mean, to begin with, the idea that this is a 18th-century system of electoral college voting that essentially disenfranchises about 80% of the population? I mean, most of us don't even know, except for the propositions here in California, we wouldn't even know there's an election going on compared to the bombardment that's going on in the swing states. So,
yeah, well, you'd know it if you were asked to give money, which many Californians have.
That's true. We're the ATM for the Democratic
New
Party.
York, California, and Texas serve that different role in the presidential election.
Texas is the Republican ATM.
Yes.
So, but just address that idea of do you, because there's a simple way to get rid of the Electoral College, which is underway, right?
You're talking about the national popular vote.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think it's actually less simple. I mean, first of all, it's interesting that the states that have passed this, the way this would work is if it passed enough states making up to 270 votes, all those states would pledge their electors to the national popular vote winner. Two problems. One is it's only passing in Democratic states. This has become another partisan issue. And the other is that I think there are serious constitutional questions as to whether or not this U.S. Supreme Court would allow this kind of agreement among the states to go through without congressional approval. There's a part of the Constitution, the Compact Clause, that prevents these states from making certain kinds of agreements without congressional approval. And so I would not trust this proposal before the current Supreme Court.
Well, and would the states that now are the swing states, would they be resistant to this? Is there any advantage to them for having being the beneficiaries of this anomaly?
Well, certainly the television stations are benefiting quite a great deal in Ohio and Florida. But I think that, you know, with the small states that would get even less attention than under a system of popular vote. Imagine where Romney and Obama would have been campaigning if they were trying to pick up as many popular votes as possible. They'd spend all their time in California, New York, and Florida. It would be a very different kind of election. It's just hard to see us moving away from the current system. You know, our Constitution has been built to make change very difficult. And now, in a very partisan and polarized era, change is even more difficult. It's hard to find people in the middle who are willing to compromise. That's putting a stop to all kinds of good election reforms.
So we're spending $6 billion on this election to end up with the status quo. That's not a message.
Well, yeah, but then you get down to how you're going to fix it, and there's very little agreement about what to do about it. And also there's, the impediment of the Supreme Court and what the court's willing to do.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Richard Hassan.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He is a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation and is co-author of a leading casebook on election law. He served as founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal, and he is the author of more than 80 articles on election law issues published by numerous journals, including the Harvard Law Review, Stanford Law Review, and Supreme Court Review. His latest book just out is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the Republican red states in this country operate on socialist right-wing welfare.
From the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Feel so assured.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Miller, Professor of Cultural Industries at the City University of London and recently the Director of the UC Studies Center in Mexico City and Chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Toby Miller is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. His latest article of the City University of London's website is The Race for the White House 2012, The New American Dream. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
Thanks very much, Ian. Good to be with you.
And your article sort of got me thinking about this great irony here in the United States, where the wealth-producing and knowledge-generating centers in the blue states of the country, like New York and California, that vote Democrat, subsidize Republican right-wing welfare in socialist red states who vote Republican. And you were just down in Mexico City there during the election, and you saw how the pre-party used their patronage system in giving out, free cards to people to shop at the shopping chain owned by a pre-supporter, etc. How different is the Mexican pre-party's patronage system from, say, the Republican Party's patronage system?
Well, it's an interesting point you make, Ian, and a provocative one. The Partido Revolucionario Institucional, the Institutional Revolutionary Party in Mexico, for decades has followed a policy of what's sometimes called incorporation, sometimes called corporatism, which is to say that whenever it's seen forms of opposition from left or right, instead of simply trying to silence them by censoring them or defeating them, it sought to incorporate them into its method of ruling. And that's why, for example, you get very radical artists, poets, writers, and so on, who, to a certain extent, actually get subsidies to do their cultural work in Mexico, despite their politics, because the idea is better to have them inside the big tent than outside it. In the United States, historically, we had something like that, very controversially and in a complex and contradictory way, with the forms in which the government would subsidize an anti-Marxist left during the Cold War in the 50s and 60s. Certain intellectuals who were opposed to Marxism, but sometimes opposed to U.S. imperialism, were nevertheless given hidden subsidies to go about their work. But it's never been as thoroughgoing a project in the U.S. However, what we do have, in my view, and not only mine, is a bizarre situation in which there is, to reuse an old phrase, socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor, but more particularly, not necessarily always for wealthy people, a form of institutionalized state intervention into the economy in the United States in Republican strongholds, but in ways that make it look as though this is not about big government when in fact it is.
Well, just the other day, Chris Christie, the Republican governor of New Jersey, which of course bore the brunt of the recent storm Sandy, he praised the Army Corps of Engineers, which is a government organization, for building sand dunes to protect a certain part of New Jersey as opposed to the others that got wiped out, and made a case for government intervention, which, of course, is a heresy with the Republican Party. But you're arguing in your article at City University of London's website, The Race for the White House 2012, The New American Dream, that most southern and western states are full of people dependent upon land-grabbed wealth or the military, relying on the military and the government buying and subsidizing weapons, drugs, and minerals. Explain that form of right-wing welfare.
Right. Well, let's start with the military. Frequently, anti-statist rhetoric in the United States completely misses out the fact that the military is, in fact, just as much a part of the government as is Medicare, as is Medicaid, as is the Internal Revenue Service, and so on. Somehow or other, the military gets a free pass as if it were just an essence of the nation that had nothing to do with government. And of course, we have an enormous military, as everybody knows. It takes up about 42% roughly of the world's expenditure on the military. And vast amounts of that goes into parts of the country where it is a major employer. As I think most of your listeners will know, the military is the biggest employer of young people in the United States. And it isn't only a direct employer of those who work for the Pentagon or work for the different arms of the military. It also is a massive employer of all kinds of high-tech and low-tech companies, the vast majority of whose work goes only to one customer, and that is the government. So the idea that government is always inefficient, that it gets in the way, that it's un-American, that it's not part of everyday life, is patently absurd when you consider this massive role of the military. I mean, there are all kinds of companies, from cell phone firms to high-tech areas, that only survive and only thrive and, in many cases, only come into being as a consequence of this investment, and massive bases all over the country as well. Just pay testimony to that. In terms of the other part of the question, not necessarily about the military, but about land grabs, speculation, and so on, again, in many cases, not necessarily through the federal government, often through state or municipal governments, there's huge coordination, there always has been, between various speculative interests within big business and small business, in particular jurisdictions, and the making available of land or the invocation of eminent domain ideas and so on in order to facilitate that sort of money-making. We, of course, have seen a lot of it in California, if not more than in other states. Just think about the whole history of Chavez Ravine in Los Angeles. So, you know, the argument that get government out of the way, entrepreneurs just make up their own minds, do their own things, and then reach out and invest. And this is magical because they're in touch with the interests of the consumers and are constantly coming up with fresh ideas. As if this were done in a vacuum, away from the participation of government, is patently absurd.
Again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, Professor of Cultural Industries at the City University of London. He was recently the director of the UC Studies Center in Mexico City and chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. His latest book is Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. And he has an article at the City University of London's website, The Race for the White House 2012, The New American Dream. Again, Governor Christie of New Jersey, again was pointed out that New Jersey gives more money to the federal government than it gets back than any other state. It's a blue state, and that's quickly followed by New York and California. Conversely, the red states like Mississippi and Alabama and the Midwestern and Western, some of the Midwestern and Western states that are red are also in that category. And you've mentioned subsidies to those states via military bases and military patronage, but there's also the farm bill is a huge source of patronage. Every year, I've some friends in Idaho were just saying every year, all these Republican white men are driving brand new pickup trucks thanks to the federal government when they get their checks, quite often for not growing crops.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this goes back a very, very long way. Obviously, there are all kinds of stories from the Great Depression of farmers being paid to destroy the land they were supposedly tilling. But the farm bill for years and years, ever since, has grown as a subsidy of corporate agriculture rather than small agriculture, as people imagine it to be. But it's done in such a way that it is sacrosanct because of the idea that you can trust a country man, a rural man, you can't trust a city man, and it's all very gendered, because of the notion of this fierce spirit of pioneering independence, autonomy, as you say, the, in a sense, mythology, the foundational mythology of the rapacious white man at the heart of American modernity. That mythology is immensely powerful. And, of course, there are very pragmatic lobbies, corporate lobbies in the agricultural sector, in Washington especially, that utilize that mythology as a means of ensuring that corporate welfare is handed out to them. So, yes, there's no doubt that's a major factor. And you know, whenever we're in major negotiations with other countries or with international organizations about free trade, much of that debate hinges on whether or not the farm lobby, the internet lobby, the Hollywood lobby is in the ascendant when it comes to dealing with particular parts of the relevant administration. But the farm bill goes on and on and on in just as absurd and corrupt a way as its equivalent in the European Union over here where I currently am. Yet, because of this rugged, pioneering, masculinist ethos of farming, it's got a special sheath that protects it, very similar to the special sheath that protects massive expenditure on the military, which is, on the one hand, that, again, this is to reiterate what I said before, this is not big government, this is the nation, but B, the idea that, you know, the birth of the country was experienced through bloodshed, through the revolution, and that the United States has always been prepared to fight for its own freedom and the freedom of others, and that this is once more something that is, in a sense, outside the government, but inside the heart, the beating spirit of every American citizen. And with that mythology in place, it becomes just as hard to attack the military as it is hard to attack the farm lobby. Those who've tried have normally come off second best.
And Toby Miller, your article, The Race for the White House 2012, The New American Dream, at the City University of London's website, says that the nation, meaning the United States, recently became the first in the world with more than half of its people living in suburbia, a quarter of them minorities. This shift from rural to urban to suburban living sees middle-class people increasingly disarticulated from cultural differences, class conflict, and public transportation. They reside in quietly sectarian private worlds. So explain that and how that's going to impact the election in terms of this red-blue divide.
Well, one of the extraordinary things about the history of the U.S. is, of course, that in real terms, it made a shift from being an agrarian to an industrial or manufacturing, quite urban country in many ways, fairly quickly in the 19th century and especially in the 20th century. What's happened since is that rapid shift of millions of people from the countryside to the city has been succeeded by a shift to suburbia. And again, your California-based listeners will be extremely familiar with this. Just look around yourselves at Orange County, for example, and the way in which that now is a place, and there are plenty of examples right around the country, Atlanta would be another one, where it's not just the case that the suburbs are white flight, where middle-class white folks want to get away from the urban conflict of interracial experience. It's lots of other ethnic groups and racial groups that move as well. And that means that inevitably you also get all kinds of office and building construction out in those places. Again, Irvine and Atlanta would be good examples. But the problem is that as a consequence of the fact that this is principally a middle-class movement, it means that these people lead privatized lives very much in their car between their home and wherever they shop and between those places and wherever they work, and don't encounter very often people who are different from them. And that one of the difficulties when you're talking about a massive multicultural nation like the U.S., with differences and conflicts that are partly about race and partly about age and partly about religion and partly about class, is that the warp and woof of everyday urban life, the requirement if you're in a big city like New York or Los Angeles or Chicago, that you simply encounter people who look and sound and act differently from you on a daily basis, is lost. Now, on the one hand, that can make people feel very comfortable. On the other, it can make them extremely intolerant because they're not used to simply rubbing shoulders and splitting apples and sinking beers with folks who are really different from them. And of course, one of the fault lines in the United States politically is over this question of difference, of sexual difference, of racial difference, of class difference, where for all their monstrosities, and you know, for what it's worth, I'm a registered independent, the Democrats are some kind of coalition of difference, and the Republicans are some kind of coalition against difference. The Republicans have all kinds of different groups that support them, but the Democrats have groups that are, in a sense, testament to all the varieties of the census. all those points of difference when it comes to religion and age and race and sexuality that I was talking about a moment ago. And so that's, I think, one of the key aspects. In addition, needless to say, the big cities tend to be democratic strongholds because they are where people rub up against difference. They are where people are unionized. They are where people are educated. And they are where people have traveled and have seen difference at first hand and don't necessarily favor big states in terms of militarism and small states in terms of compassion.
Well, Toby Miller, we've only got a few minutes left. You also say in your article, Governor Romney favors slashing public expenditures on higher education. President Obama seeks minor increases. Polling indicates the general public wants to double the tertiary education budget and make monumental cuts to the Pentagon. Obama is as imperial a president as Romney aspires to be. Both are weak men, tools of the prevailing political economy. They are as vulnerable as they are imperial. So, pretty damning. I can see that you are an independent. I think one could make the case that the Republicans have made a wise investment in ignorance, and we will know on Tuesday or Wednesday whether that has paid off. Your basic message here is that America needs to invest in knowledge and disavow empire.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, despite the ideological power of the myths that I talked about before, as I indicated, the opinion polls show that the majority of people realize the Pentagon is a bloated enterprise in every conceivable way, and that the massive investments that the states and the federal government have made in higher education really ever since the Civil War, and especially in the century and a half thereafter, were crucial in making this country a world leader in knowledge, in applied knowledge, in technology, in science, in medicine, and in much of the arts and the social sciences too. And that something has to be done about rebalancing those aspects. That we are simply creating an impossible rod for our backs economically with the amount of money we spend on the military, given how little it returns in terms of ideas and commodifiable practices, things and products and services by contrast with the universities. And also that, again, part of our military world is to take young men in particular, but also young women, away from higher education and into military service, when it would be much better if they were honing their skills and their innovations inside universities or other forms of higher ed. So I think that there's no doubt that that really needs to happen. In terms of the imperial presidency, both parties have sought over the last 30 years to restore the imperial presidency to the status that it had before Watergate and the rise of administrative law really tore down much of the authority that the presidency had. And I mean that in two ways. First of all, the notion of the president as almost above the law. And secondly, in terms of overseas ambitions, the desire to be an all-powerful hegemonic force, reassuring and buttressing U.S. economic interests around the world, but also operating for its own sake as an imperial power broker. It seems to me that we're facing a situation economically where that simply isn't sustainable. It cannot go on. And all the debates about the deficit and the debt that we have that orient themselves around cutting public programs do not really address the issue that some of the public programs, in particular educational ones, have a monumental return on investment. Most of the military programs do not. And many other much more productive, peaceful, and practical jobs could be found for people currently on the government coin in those areas if we were simply to think about, in a sense, moving away from this imperial presidency and instead turning towards a smart country.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Toby Miller. Toby, bye-bye.
Hi. Thanks, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who is in London. He's a professor of cultural industries at the City University of London and recently the director of the UC Studies Center in Mexico City and chair of the Department of Media and Cultural Studies at the University of California, Riverside. Toby Miller is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. And his books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Captured the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Greening the Media and Blow Up the Humanities. His latest article at the City University of London's website is The Race for the White House 2012, The New American Dream. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about another aspect of Mitt Romney that has been off limits, his role as a member of the Mormon royalty and his connections to the hierarchy of the Mormon Church.
You need it, that's for sure.
I believe that he sent his only son to die for my sins. And I believe that ancient Jews built boats and sailed to America. I am a Mormon, and a Mormon just believes. You cannot just believe.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kay Birmingham, who is a civil trial attorney with over 25 years' experience in California and Utah, representing both corporate defendants and individual plaintiffs. Born and raised in Bountiful, Utah, she was a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints for most of her life until resigning from the church in 2001. She's the author of An American Fraud, One Lawyer's Case Against Mormonism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kay Birmingham.
Thank you, Ian.
And Kay, you left the church have obviously written a book I don't think particularly flattering towards the church. But I believe that you are among what, 1 to 1.5 million Mormons who have resigned from the Church of Latter-day Saints since 1995.
Yes, I think that's an approximation. Of course, the numbers aren't specific because the church doesn't like to keep records of who leave. And so you will find, if you look especially at the Trinity College study that came out about a year ago now, that the LDS Church constantly overreports its membership. And if you go to the Trinity College study, there's about half as many LDS in the United States as the Mormon Church records would indicate.
So we started out, of course, with a musical clip from the musical Out Now, or the Book of Mormon. But much of what you've written about, Kay Birmingham, in An American Fraud, One Lawyer's Case Against Mormonism, has to do with the divinity of the Book of Mormon. As recently as 2003, the then head of the church, President Gordon Hinckley, said, "Each of us has to face the matter. Either the church is true or it is a fraud. There is no middle ground. It is the church and kingdom of God or it is nothing." What would you say?
Well, it's interesting because when people hear that, the average Mormon members, they think of it as just a rhetorical statement that certainly this church that I've loved and grown up in has to be true because I've borne my testimony since I was a young child. I've borne witness that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God and this is the one and only true church. And so they don't think about what the content of that statement might in fact be doing, which as a trial attorney, you encounter this all the time, and that is giving notice to the people that the church could be a fraud or is based upon fraud, thereby starting the running of the statute of limitations for any claim against the church for fraud, for misrepresenting its origins. And that's just one thing that I find very disconcerting about the LDS hierarchy and the way they play the naivete and their ability to manipulate the membership for their own purposes and in order to increasingly gain wealth.
Well, specifically, the founder of the church, Joseph Smith, the whole thing is fairly requires a certain suspense of belief, suspense of disbelief, I should say, with these golden tablets that mysteriously disappear and all of this stuff and the Egyptian papyrus, which turned out to be a fraud, etc.
Right.
My understanding, actually, from the historian William Manchester, is that the book itself was a stolen manuscript of a 19th century science fiction writer who Smith stole it from a rooming house in Atlanta. So, I mean, it's possible the whole thing itself is simply a plagiarized on top of the
right.
questionable nature of its content.
Right, and there's all sorts of theories about where Joseph Smith and or his colleagues, so to speak, who were all in the golden Bible business or the gold book business, as it was called back then, got their information or their storyline or their sources. And, in fact, there's a really recent book that came out that compares the percentages of the books of The Adventures of Marco Polo, a really old version, I think it was 1808, and shows similarities in a certain portion of the Book of Mormon that track, whether it's numbers or names or storylines, the Book of Mormon. So there's all sorts of different theories on how Joseph Smith and his buddies came up with the Book of Mormon. But the one thing that is absolutely clear is it's not what it purports to be and what the leaders tell its members, and that is that it's an engraving on golden plates in ancient Reformed Egyptian of the history of early American prophets that was buried and that was located by Joseph Smith after an angel told him where to find it. He dug it up, and he translated the Book of Mormon from those plates. That has absolutely been proven to not be the case.
Surprise, surprise. Again, I'm speaking with Kay Birmingham, a civil trial attorney who was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for most of her life until resigning from the church in 2001, and she's the author of An American Fraud, One Lawyer's Case Against Mormonism. Now, you have recently interviewed Park Romney, and now, of course, one would assume that he has to be a part of the Romney family. My understanding is that the Romneys are Mormon royalty with ancestors dating back to the earliest followers of Joseph Smith, including Parley Pratt and Miles Romney, who was the church's first architect.
That's correct. And there's an individual called Miles Park Romney, who's the common, I believe it's great-grandfather, of Mitt Romney and Park Romney. And he actually had to go to Mexico so that he could practice polygamy after 1890, and the manifesto was declared as a condition of statehood for Utah. And Park Romney is actually a friend of mine. He's written a really good book on Mormon epistemology.
Now, what's his relationship to Mitt?
A second cousin.
Second cousin, I see.
Yeah, so which I'm sure there are, you know, dozens of second cousins to Mitt, and I don't think they've ever met. But as one of many former Mormons, he's a sociologist and comments on the corrupt epistemology of Mormonism from the very beginning. You're not taught as a child that, you know, you should be honest or honor your parents, the basic truths that certain religions will instill in their children. Instead, children are taught to recite, Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, this is the one and only true church, even as a toddler, and they have no reason to really believe that, or they're not. It's just very corrupt. And so young people, and this is my theory, and this has been true with the leaders all along, from Joseph Smith, the original founder, to Brigham Young, and the way he abused the pioneers for his own gain in building up the Great Basin Kingdom through Joseph Smith, the next Joseph Smith in the Smoot hearings. B.H. Roberts spent 2 days, he was a church historian in the early 20th centuries, and he spent 2 days in front of the 12 apostles telling them that from his investigation, the Book of Mormon appeared to be a fraud and was not what it purported to be. And one of the 12 apostles said, well, is this going to help our prestige? Andy says, no, this is not. And so they just said, well, then keep it quiet. And they sent him back east to, out of the way. So that,
right. And, of course, the 12 apostles are, there is the prophet who's the head of the church. He's called the prophet. And the board of directors, if you will, are the 12 apostles.
That's right.
I started out the program by pointing out how our pathetic press and the feckless Democrats have not forced Romney to reveal his taxes and list of bundlers. And this other subject that's been off limits is his role as a member of Mormon royalty and his connection to the vast finances generated by tithing that the secretive hierarchy of the Mormon prophet and his disciples have at their disposal. I'd like to focus in on that if we could. I mean, Bloomberg had a story on Monday that was overshadowed by the storm that there are ties to Romney's money and having him essentially sheltered through the church as a tax avoidance scheme.
Right.
But there's also some speculation out there that as a venture capitalist, Romney had access to the vast financial float that the Mormon Church has, that these secretive group of elderly men control, the tithing. There must be billions of dollars involved, right?
Yes, that's correct. And the church, although some people like to call it a corporation, it really isn't, and there's no accountability as there would be in a regular corporation to its shareholders, because they're just members and they donate their tithing. They don't invest. And so it's interesting. Nobody knows the extent to which Romney's assets, whether through Bain or other assets, are involved with the church. I do know there is one researcher who is working on a project for me who has found SEC filings that have Bain and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, through their corporation Soul, divesting themselves of stock in several different global companies on the same dates. And so you see a lot of these transactions in the SEC filings where those two are co-owners or have the same interests, and actually the transactions are absolutely similar or on the same date or almost identical. So I don't know. It would be interesting to be able to find that out, but nobody really knows, because the church quit reporting what it did with its money and how much money it took in decades and decades ago.
So what about the notion that it would seem that it sort of does sound a bit like a corporation, though, with this kind of the prophets being a board of director and the apostles being the board of director and the prophet being the CEO, and they do have all this money and they do invest a lot of it, don't they? There's I spoke recently with a popular radio commentator in Salt Lake City, who was actually, he had written a piece in Salon, I think it was, that some of the original tenets of Mormonism were fairly socialist, in the sense that these were pioneer communities that depended upon sharing solidarity amongst all of the settlers, of working together, and that he was decrying the fact that it's become so materialistic and there's some giant development that the LDS Church is involved in, that's building some huge mall full of all of the designer-labeled high-end consumption stuff.
That's absolutely right. But the church is headquartered and ruled by very, very smart PR men and attorneys. And there's not, you'll have to look really hard to find a theologian amongst them. They're very, very business-oriented. And because of that, and because they've been sued before, and they want to protect their assets, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints only exists as a trademark. It's a name that's owned by Intellectual Reserve, which is one of their companies. And it's always very difficult, if somebody wants to sue the church, to know who to name, because they very carefully try to separate the church business, that is the collection of income from the tithes and the donations, from the actual investing in, say, City Creek, which is the mall that you just spoke about. And that is under the organization called Deseret Management. And so it's a really, really complicated sort of conglomerate. And they've been very careful to sort of, bright line the differences. But one has to, if you trace it all the way back to the very beginning, it all began with the tithe. So
but as we said at the beginning, what surprised me, and you are a living testament to it, a lot of people are leaving the Mormon Church. I understand it's also true of Scientology, which it was literally founded by a science fiction writer. In this case, Mormonism was founded by a guy who stole a science fiction manuscript.
Well, yeah, and he was a lot, you know, in the church you grow up learning, oh, Joseph Smith was a young, ignorant, poor farm boy. He was a good man, young man, and he just, God chose him because of his innocence. Well, actually, he lived very close to the Erie Canal in Palmyra, and it opened just during this time period when he claimed to have been visited by an angel, and he was a voracious reader. And if you look at the primary source documents, and I'm not the only one by any means who's written about this, and there are many scholarly historians. For one that comes to mind is D. Michael Quinn, who's really the expert on some of these primary sources. He read Captain Kidd's Adventures, he read Marco Polo, all these different things, and he had quite the imagination. And so it's really not a stretch to think that he could dictate something that could be his ultimate scam. And it's, of course, succeeded beyond, I'm sure, his expectations.
Sure. But, well, just in the last minute then, I'm sorry to butt in, but does Mitt Romney believe it? I mean, we don't know what he believes. That's what's so disturbing about this, that he's either been lying to all of his supporters on the right through the primary period, and then suddenly on the first debate he switched to becoming a moderate overnight. So he's either lying to the moderates or he's lying to the conservative backers of his ticket. So what's your sense? And because it's this, I mean, the religion does work for a lot of people. It's a very family oriented religion. So I'm curious to know. And that's what we don't know about this man. We don't know about what motivates him and how much he believes of this strange so-called theology of his religion.
That's exactly right. And he's, as you know, stayed away from issues addressing his belief. And whether he's a dupe, one of the people that believe it regardless, or a deceiver, one of the members of the hierarchy that are deceiving the rest of...
Hello, do we lose you?
No, I don't think so. I'm still here.
Okay. So you said there's a dupe or a deceiver. He's one of the deceivers. Explain that.
Well, I'm only saying that I don't know, but whichever he is, he's not the kind of person that should be president of the United States.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Kay Burningham.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Kay Burningham, who's a civil trial attorney with over 25 years' experience in California and Utah, representing both corporate defendants and individual plaintiffs. Born and raised in Bountiful, Utah, she was a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for most of her life until resigning from the church in 2001. She's the author of An American Fraud, One Lawyer's Case Against Mormonism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at Facebook / Ian Masters Media. I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared.